Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The global rally looks set to extend today. U.S. stocks rally for the fourth straight session overnight amid optimism over the reopening of the global economy. Asian stocks are trading higher this morning as well. Here at home, the SDI opened up 1.3%. Investors clearly hoping for a swift rebound. Is it time to put risk in or take risk off the table? How are smart investors reading the market? We're going to check in now with Arun Pai. He's Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Arun, how are you and your family doing?
Very good, Michelle. Thank you very much for asking. I hope it's the same on your side too.
Absolutely. All safe and well. Good to hear. Okay, let's start with hot spot today, Hong Kong. Despite a vigil ban, Hong Kong is to lead the morning of pro-democracy Tiananmen protests of 1989, despite an order issued by the Hong Kong police force, citing, of course, social distancing rules. The market, though, looking out for protests online or around the city. In the meantime, two of Hong Kong's biggest banks have come out on the side of Beijing, endorsing China's new security law for the territory. So lots of twists and turns in this story. The Hang Seng has been consistently trading up these past few days. What is your reading, Arun, of Hong Kong unrest impacting markets?
Right. So, you know, obviously unrest makes a lot of media news headlines. But is that necessarily translated into market or a large market correction? Mm-hmm. Not quite, as can be clearly seen over the past, you know, since about a year and a half of all these Hong Kong protests. I think this is going to be the new reality for the next foreseeable future, for that matter, where you have a lot more pull from China to try and convert Hong Kong or bring it within its own existing ecosystem. But at the same time, you have a lot of protests from people trying to still distance themselves and trying to still ensure that it's going to be two different autonomous governments. We are seeing a lot more activity in terms of, be it politicians, be it large, like HSBC's Asia chairman came out also. Mm-hmm. And they naturally, for business purposes, they will have to side with China. What that will lead to in terms of the general population over the next couple of years, especially if the Hong Kong government does not figure out its housing situation, its job situation given the COVID pandemic, what will happen to the state of the economy over the next year or when hopefully the borders start opening up a lot more and hopefully travel and tourism starts coming back in, business travel, etc. I think there's going to be a lot of other factors that leads to whether the inherent local population is happy with the existing situation on the street or whether it will keep boiling and spilling over into them sadly coming out in the streets, doing protests, blaming China or blaming pretty much anyone for the plight that they're in. So I think it's going to be a very tough situation mm-hmm. with a lot of uncertain clouds of what exactly is going to happen to the business, to the economy over the next 6 months to a year.
Are you seeing any signs that the unrest is putting pressure on the Hong Kong dollar?
So it's interesting, right? Because the Hong Kong dollar has been pegged for a number of years between 775 and 785. There are a couple of features or factors that really affect it. First and foremost is the interest rate differential between Hong Kong dollars versus U.S. dollars. The Fed has basically brought down interest rates to zero in the U.S. So what people can do is transfer money out of U.S. dollars, transfer it into Hong Kong dollars, earning higher interest rates, which the Hong Kong equivalent Fed has set. And hence, you're basically, you know, pegging your currency. So you'd have no underlying risk per se, unless, of course, the peg breaks. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're earning a higher interest rate, which is why we've seen the Hong Kong dollar appreciate to the lower end, i.e. 7.75 of its band. Now, in addition to that, we are seeing a lot of capital flight taking place from China, where the economy slowed down substantially. A lot of trade war news is coming out on a day-to-day basis, especially over the last couple of weeks, as we've discussed on your show over the last couple of weeks. So a lot of money is coming out of China, and what's the easiest thing that they can do? Send it across to Hong Kong, thereby letting the Hong Kong dollar appreciate even more. So it's for the short term, at least, there are definitely a couple of really strong factors that is trying to make Hong Kong dollar appreciate. The problem, though, is obviously in the slightly longer term, right, like 6 months or a year from now, what is going to be the state of Hong Kong itself? Is the HKMA, the equivalent of the Fed, does it have the balance sheet to protect its currency on either side of the spectrum? Right now, absolutely. What is going to be the more longer-term effects of COVID? What is going to be the longer-term effects of the unrest that takes place in China, in Hong Kong, sorry? And what is China going to do with respect to Hong Kong? The U.S.-Hong Kong trade wars, and obviously the U.S. interest rate differential with Hong Kong dollars. If the U.S. Economy starts getting back as it is right now on a reasonably solid footing, and the Fed starts raising interest rates again, a lot of capital can flow out of Hong Kong back into the U.S. dollar, can start flowing into Singapore because, you know, the whole Hong Kong-Singapore divide, not wanting to keep capital within any kind of a reach of Chinese authorities, etc. So things can change relatively quickly, and it can easily go from Hong Kong dollar appreciating to Hong Kong dollar depreciating substantially. And there are, the you know, a couple of hedge fund managers that I talked to, a couple of them have taken positions accordingly to try and monetize that view. And, you know, and a lot of people have lost their shirt over the number of years trying to do that. Don't take me wrong. But, you know, there are always new players in the casino, I guess. So.
Well said. All right, speaking of Hong Kong, I want to focus on NetEase, because NetEase is the second largest mobile gaming company in the world behind Tencent. And NetEase listeners offers games and online education, music streaming, other internet services. And this Chinese gaming company is expected to begin trading in Hong Kong on June 11th. It's actually been trading on the NASDAQ since 2000. It's looking to raise $3 billion, though, in a secondary listing in Hong Kong. This is going to be Hong Kong's biggest stock sale so far this year. NetEase has pointed to that proposed U.S. bill we've been talking about that would prevent Chinese companies that refuse to open their books from listing on Wall Street as a potential risk factor. That bill's been described as one which aims to kick deceitful Chinese companies off U.S. exchanges. So, Arun, is Hong Kong's exchange likely to benefit from increased volumes of listing of Chinese tech companies?
Oh, most definitely. They have done a fantastic job of playing the political tightrope over here to as large an extent as possible, taking advantage of the situation, as you just highlighted, where Chinese companies have been listing on U.S. exchanges, raising billions of dollars of capital. And Hong Kong has proven to Chinese companies, if you want to raise a substantial chunk of money, you can also do that from Hong Kong, which is obviously a lot more in control by China. You've seen that with Alibaba. You've seen that with a number of other companies in the recent past to showcase the fact that Hong Kong is able to pull its weight. We discussed this in last week's episode, the whole MSCI coup against SGX. You know, fantastic. In spite of all the unrest, the U.S.-Hong Kong trade wars, China-Hong Kong issues, they have managed to convince the world, and especially companies looking to raise capital, that they are in very steady grounds. And they've done a couple of smart things, like they changed the rules of voting rights versus actual ownership of shares for corporates, making itself at par with that of NASDAQ and other U.S.-listed exchanges, thereby making it a very attractive location or economy for Chinese companies to list in. Coming specifically to NetEase, you know, it makes you have, as multinational corporations in this day and age, just like NetEase, there are so many others, it makes so much more sense to try and have multiple listings. Now, again, this does not work for smaller companies because the costs, you know, really, really jack up on the back of that, of multiple listings. Be it compliance, be it listing fees, lawyer fees, etc., just the whole M&A angle to it. But in terms of if you are decently large enough, and obviously NetEase is one of those companies, it makes a lot of sense because you have literally no idea how poor the U.S.-China trade war, or pretty much any other trade war, which other wall can be erected between two governments that brings your listing to a potential grinding halt. So diversify your eggs over here, spread them out a little bit, exactly like what's happening to supply chains too. So yes, it makes a lot of sense.
So let's take a closer look at NetEase, because there is interest in the retail tranche for this secondary listing. It easily beat first quarter targets, even despite a pandemic, $4.60 per American depositary share on revenue of $2.4 billion in the March quarter. What is your reading of NetEase in this sector, the computer software gaming sector?
Right. So over like close to three-fourths of the revenue of NetEase is from the gaming segment. A couple of other interesting aspects of them, something like 20-24%, give or take, is under the segment called innovative businesses, which are related to, you know, music, streaming videos, ads, etc., which has obviously taken a little bit of a hit during the COVID pandemic. And they have an educational learning arm of Udel, which they've actually spun off in recent past to take advantage of the fact that, you know, multiples that you're getting for educational-related businesses are relatively high. They still have a majority ownership stake now. So it's an interesting company because close to 80% of its business is in gaming and education, which has been relatively online education, which has been extremely shielded by the COVID pandemic. So I can see why a lot of retail players would find this gaming segment something very attractive to, like you mentioned, because it's something that they can relate to quite extensively during the work from home period. Like, I mean, honestly, which of us hasn't just pulled out their phone, downloaded a game, and just checked this thing out, right? So there's obviously that element of relatability. There's the element that a lot of retail people have a lot of free time right now, which can be seen by the number of brokerage accounts opened up. And so you put the two things together and you're like, voila, it makes a lot of sense to get into gaming stocks. My personal take, though, is it's a bit risky because just think about the number. I don't presume that you are an avid gamer, neither am I, but just going by stuff online, like ads that are coming up online, people's attention span is quite short, right? Like in Singapore, that game where everyone was running around trying to capture those Pokemons and stuff, like it took the country and the world by storm for all of like a month.
Yeah.
Billions of dollars had to be put in to ensure that billions of users could come onto its platform. But then after a couple of months, suddenly the craze for that game died down. And that is why it becomes very difficult from an investor's perspective as to try and pick the winner in this space. Like, you really need to keep your ear very close to the ground and anticipate which game is going to become quote-unquote hot. Now, personally, from the aspect of if I'm a retail investor who really wants exposure into this space, rather than taking pure-play gaming companies and potentially having a lot more volatility in your portfolio, companies like NetEase itself, to some extent, even though it has a larger percentage related to gaming, companies like Microsoft, Tencent, Sony, that have a number of diversified arms of be it entertainment, enterprise software, yet gaming plays a reasonably sizable percentage within its company structure, that could be something that's a little bit more interesting. And I'd just like to finish off with one more thing just for your viewers to pay a little bit more attention to is Chinese regulation. A lot of these mega billion-dollar companies have been set up or whose market cap is what it is currently is because of the rapid growth in China. And, you know, the whole longer-term effects on young kids in terms of violent games, in terms of spending 10 hours, 15 hours, 20 hours sometimes in front of the computer screen has led China to clamp down on a number of its gaming companies, Tencent included, quite substantially. And so that's something to be potentially be, you know, to watch out for retail investors.
I did not know that. I'm going to have to read up on that. And as to whether I'm an avid gamer, I'll tell you that I have thought of buying one of these games. Instead, I bought a gaming chair because they look so comfortable.
They are. That's another unicorn, by the way, in Singapore.
Really?
By Heliconia, yeah. Secret Labs.
Secret Labs. I have my very own Game of Thrones throne at home.
Already there.
All right. For the listeners, NetEase is going to close the books on its international offer at 4 p.m. in all regions. And on Friday for the Hong Kong public offer, it'll price at 10 a.m. Hong Kong time the same day. That's according to sources. We're speaking with Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Okay, so NetEase is good for Hong Kong's exchange. Let's come back home. When it comes to the SGX, we saw analysts revise downwards sharply SGX target price recently. One revised it down to 740 after the Bourse operator announced a reduction in its license agreement with MSCI. SGX management has guided for a profit impact from this to be in the region of 10 to 15%. We talked about this last week, but soon after, SGX announced the launch of 10 Singapore single stock futures, this on June 15th. SGX share price, let me check that out for you. It is currently $8.41, showing a gain of 1.57% this morning. Arun, do you expect this new shelf of instruments to attract many investors?
I think the jury's still out on that one. I think one of the biggest issues that the Singapore Exchange, at least on the equity side, has always been faced with is just the lack of interest in the investment community to get exposure to the whole breadth of stocks there. Sure. In terms of the REIT sector, definitely Singapore has done a good job in attracting the larger listings. But excluding that, pretty much every other sector has been playing second fiddle to Hong Kong or the rest of the exchanges. So coming up with, and yes, while SGX has been pushing a lot more on the derivative side, which is why the whole MSCI loss has hurt them so badly, coming up with single name derivatives of equities that many people do not have that much interest in anyway, will that really make a sizable difference to the bottom line? I don't think so. And the market reaction has also been relatively quite muted to that fact. And then I think it'll be adopting a lot more of a wait and see approach of how much more depth and width SGX can bring to its derivatives market.
What kind of investors are likely to be interested in these SSF single stock futures?
Right. So single stock future is nothing but a derivative instrument where the buyer and seller agree to a certain date, which is set by the exchange, agree to a certain price to exchange the underlying instrument, which is in this case a single stock, but the quantity of which is 100 shares. So it's a derivative instrument that is by nature risky, because you're trying to fix the price that is exchanged at a certain date, but it's leveraged up because of the amount, the quantity, i.e. it's 100 shares per underlying contract. So the kind of people who typically get involved in this are your more sophisticated investors, and or at least they should be more involved in this, are your sophisticated investors and obviously your hedge funds. So when it comes to stuff that is more largely used by the larger investing houses, like MSCI indices and stuff, it makes a lot of sense for funds to use it to potentially gain magnified exposure to the underlying because of the leverage, or to use it in a smart manner to try and protect your downside for the purposes of hedging. So you can buy like a whole bunch of underlyings yourself, but you can go short the future, i.e. this derivative instrument, to some extent to protect your underlying asset, which is the long outright purchase of these stocks. When it comes to, and that's very useful when you're dealing with highly public or very extensively used underlyings. When it comes to single name stocks, I have a fear that it will lead to potentially a lot more retail people trying to take advantage of this leverage, thinking that they can time the market which, you know, professionals find it next to impossible, leave alone even retail people. I just fear that this might lead to a lot more risk-taking than what should be undertaken by a retail investor.
You're listening to Money and Me. I'm Michelle Martin, speaking with Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Let's talk about the Zoom boom and whether the Zoom boom, Arun, is going to continue as we all go back to work. Should we be looking away from stay-home stocks to get back out there stocks? Let's look at Zoom's results. The video communications company that nobody knew last year has become a household name during this pandemic, reporting a net income of $27 million or 9 cents a share, compared with net income of $200,000 or less than a penny a share in the year-ago quarter. All right, so tell me, was this immense rise expected in your books?
The extent, no. But the fact that they were going to have a fantastic quarter, yes. I mean, you could see where people who had never heard of the company, as you had mentioned, so many people are talking about it. It's naturally going to lead to a substantial share price appreciation. And it obviously means that a lot of people are using the product. Now, given the number of meetings that I've had working from home in the last couple of months, Zoom has definitely been, a godsend. Its user interface is phenomenal. The technology that it uses, even with relatively weaker connections, fantastic job, right? Like, not for a second am I disputing the quality of the product. But taking a step back from the perspective of an investor, I would say, at least from the perspective of a value investor, I find it quite difficult to believe that the valuation of this company can be, currently it's at $225, which equates to probably slightly over a $60 billion market cap. Mm. Why is that? They come out with, revenue, as you mentioned, of like close to $330 million, up close to 2x, right, from the last year. They are predicting a revenue of about $500 million in Q2. And they've also predicted a revenue of $1.8 billion for the entire year. So just a very simple back-of-the-envelope calculation, that means for the next three quarters, given the fact that they've already earned or already generated revenues of $300 million plus the first quarter, it seems like it's going to be a relatively steady state at $500 million. Again, substantially larger than what anyone would have predicted come November of last year, but the share price has also appreciated from 75 to 225. So it's gone up like close to 3x since then. So you're talking about a company that is basically going to have a revenue of $1.8 billion. Their gross margins have corrected a little bit from 80% down to 68% because of the difficulty in conversion of free users to paid. So, if you're dealing with a conference that you need it to last for more than 45 minutes, or you need a certain number of people attending that call, then yes, you will pay for it. Hence, your larger businesses or even like your companies that have more than, say, 10 employees will definitely switch to a paid use case. Can they make the entire software paid? I think that will be extremely difficult to pull off from a PR perspective when this pandemic is going on, or for that matter, when the pandemic ends. So you're dealing in a situation where $1.8 billion revenue for the year, even taking, say, a 15-20% net income margin, converting that into a $63 billion company, you're dealing at like PE multiples of like 200, 300, which is quite remarkable for a company whose, at least even the growth this year, given the COVID situation, is not going to be appreciating that much from this point onwards. Not for the past 6 months. Phenomenal job. Love the product. Just a question of the valuation of it.
All right. Love that. I have about 6,000 more questions for you, but we're going to have to wrap it up for the news. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Thanks, Arun. Have a great day.
Thank you, Michelle. You too.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.